You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're headed to a quiet street in El Sereno, where mother and activist Martha Escudero is showing us around the cozy house that she shares with her two kids.
I have a small array of plants, and we created like garden fairy style gardens with the cacti. And also, we have a lot of books.
There's an altar atop the mantle with photos of heroes and lost loved ones, a pet turtle named Jade, and a desk in the living room for homeschooling lessons.
I homeschool now just one of my daughters and sometimes other people from the community. We created...
Escudero and her kids love this house and their El Sereno community. But soon they might be facing eviction, and not because they can't pay rent. In 2020, Escudero was part of a radical group of housing activists who began occupying more than a dozen publicly owned vacant houses in this neighborhood. Well, back then, they fought for and won the right to live in those houses temporarily. Well, now they're fighting once again, but this time to stay for good. KCRW's Zoe Matthew has the story.
It was a gloomy day in early November when Martha Escudero received the 3-day notice to vacate her home. She wasn't really surprised. In fact, she'd been anticipating this day for a while. The 2-year temporary housing contract she'd signed with the city's housing authority had expired about a week earlier, but that didn't make the news any easier to stomach.
I guess I already expected it, but I just didn't think it would be so soon.
At this point, Escudero is tired of moving. Before living here, she spent a year and a half unhoused and couch surfing with her school-aged daughters. The three of them sometimes found themselves living in cramped spaces or sleeping on the floor at the homes of friends and family members. So, at the beginning of the pandemic, fed up with the instability and looking for somewhere to shelter in place, Escudero made a life-changing decision.
We are reclaimers!
Mighty, mighty reclaimers!
The mighty, mighty reclaimers!
She banded together with a group of other unhoused and housing-insecure Angelenos calling themselves the Reclaimers. They asserted that they had a right to use empty, government-owned housing to protect themselves from COVID-19. And in March 2020, they began occupying vacant houses owned by the state transit agency Caltrans. Here's Escudero speaking to a crowd of supporters on the day she moved in.
I am not a squatter. My family's not a squatter. Ruby's not a squatter. We are here getting what was owed
to us. Taking back what's ours.
Bought by the agency decades ago for a now-abandoned expansion of the 710 freeway, many of these houses had been boarded up for years. The Reclaimers felt that there was no excuse for keeping them empty when tens of thousands of people were living on the street.
We're paying for these homes. We've been paying for these homes. They're state-owned, and they're empty.
And surprisingly, local officials agreed. In late 2020, the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles, or HACLA, began leasing 23 of the houses from Caltrans to use for a transitional housing program. They let Escudero and the other Reclaimers stay and brought in some other unhoused Angelenos as well. But that program was never meant to be permanent. From the get-go, HACLA's goal was to transition participants into other housing. And the Reclaimers have always had a different vision for the neighborhood. They want the houses returned to community control.
The vision from the community is really that all these resources be in the service of community in perpetuity.
That's Sue Hernandez, executive director of the El Sereno Community Land Trust. For years, her organization has been helping the Reclaimers look for ways to buy the Caltrans homes so they can live in them permanently. Essentially, land trusts are designed to keep land affordable while stewarding it on behalf of a community. They often do this by setting up housing cooperatives, which allow low-income residents to own their homes. Hernandez says this model is more sustainable than government-run programs, which are often temporary and force participants to comply with strict rules. She has fielded repeated complaints from the Reclaimers about the fact that their housing contracts bar them from doing things like having overnight guests or drinking alcohol.
That is carceral housing. It's one step away from having the door shut and locked on you on a regular basis.
According to Jenny Scanlon, Hackless Strategic Development Officer, these rules are par for the course. She says the reclaimers agreed to them when they moved in.
If they get into the program and they realize, you know, it's not for me, then they have every right to leave the program and find a different home or a different program that works better for them.
In any case, they might not have a choice but to leave soon. The program's 24-month time limit, which is mandated by a state health code, is inching ever closer. Escudero and another reclaimer named Benito Flores were the first to get their 3-day notices, but others will in the coming months. While Hakla has offered Escudero some alternative housing options, including city-run hotel rooms and apartments in other neighborhoods, she says all of them are either too expensive or too far away.
So that means I would have to move outside my support system and my community, and that is actually, in my opinion, violent and traumatic.
Over the past 2 years, she's formed a homeschooling co-op with her neighbors, become involved with the community garden.
We have workshops there and classes, and we've invited also members of Anahuacolmeca, a local indigenous school where my youngest daughter now attends this year.
For Escudero, this community support has lightened the load of being a single mom.
They always have that saying that it takes a village to raise a child, but in capitalism, it's really difficult to do. So we're trying to like build those networks of like relationship building and co-parenting and community.
Meanwhile, Caltrans is finally starting to auction off some of the vacant houses, and the Community Land Trust wants to stake a claim. In October, the organization teamed up with two other local nonprofits to place a bid on 37 of the El Sereno properties. To be clear, these aren't the same houses that Hakla is leasing. But the goals outlined in the bid reflect the same ones the reclaimers have been pushing for since the beginning. If their plan is selected by Caltrans, they'll finally be able to establish a housing cooperative for low-income tenants and return some of the homes to the community. They also plan to refurbish the houses and add density, with backyard homes and multifamily apartments. But they aren't the only ones vying for the properties. 8 other organizations are also bidding to create or rehab affordable housing here, including the City of Los Angeles.
We evaluated every single property to see what would fit on that site and what could be constructed or rehabbed in a way to quickly make affordable housing a reality.
That's LA City Council member Kevin De Leon last December. The city has already set aside funding for his plan to buy up these and other properties in the 710 corridor, making way for hundreds of affordable housing units. A few months back, the city's bid would have been tough to beat. But that was before De Leon was implicated in a scandal where he and other council members were caught making racist remarks on tape. So it remains to be seen which vision for El Sereno Caltrans will move forward with. And Escudero, too, remains uncertain about her future. If the land trust is awarded the houses, she might be able to move into one of those eventually, and could even have a shot at ownership. But she'd rather just find a way to stay where she is.
It would just make it much easier for everybody if they made a pathway to transition in place in homes. These are not shelters, so I don't see the need, like the logical, humane need to like be transferred.
One thing that is clear, though, is that the reclaimers don't plan to give up the fight anytime soon.
Fight, fight, fight! Housing is a human right! Fight, fight, fight!
For KCRW, I'm Zoe Matthew.
Fight, fight! Housing is a human right!
All right, coming up, a new member of Congress looks to Washington, trying to do the work that voters sent her there to do. But how, given the current political environment? More on that just ahead, after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. In the latest LA vote count, Karen Bass is leading her opponent, Rick Caruso, in the mayor's race. Bass is vacating her congressional seat that represents parts of South and West LA, Inglewood and Culver City. And Sidney Kamlager will be the one taking her place in Washington, a very different town than deep blue Sacramento, California. Kamlager beat out LA City Councilwoman Jan Perry for the post. She's currently a state senator serving out a term that she won in a special election, the former assembly member where she served one term in Sacramento as well. And the Congresswoman-elect Kamlager is with us right now from Washington. Welcome to you and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be on your show.
It's going to be a very different experience in Washington, no doubt, than deep blue Sacramento, right?
I think so. I know for certain the commute is going to be a lot longer. But even though we had the supermajority in Sacramento, oftentimes we were fighting against folks within our own party. So I think having the wherewithal to manage through sharp elbows is a skill set you need, regardless of if you're in Sacramento or Washington, D.C.
What experience will you lean on as you work in a very divided Congress? Something that you've never had to deal with before.
Right. Well, you know, I was chair of the Los Angeles County delegation, an informal delegation in Sacramento, and it was bicameral, bipartisan. I learned to really listen to folks' perspectives and what they were grappling with in their own district. And I learned to try to find commonalities, because oftentimes if you can find that, it's a great foundation on which to build. I also learned how to meditate and woo-saw a lot of crazy and drama. And so I think I'm going to take all of those tools and put them in my little toolkit and find my way to Washington, D.C.
You're going to obviously need a lot of meditation, right, in such a divided Washington. And I just wonder, I mean, your legislative accomplishments in Sacramento in your short time there included a bill reducing single-use plastics, a bill to have unarmed responders for nonviolent 911 calls. Can you pass things like that in a Washington that is very different?
I think you can. And in this Congress, the 117th, in these past 2 years, we have seen a very divided Congress find ways with a very divided Senate to work with this administration to get major pieces of legislation passed. But at the end of the day, I think this election proved that the American people are tired of nonsense, they are tired of immaturity, and they are tired of folks not being civil. They want us to show up to work, and they want us to find solutions to help them live in a way in which they feel safe, in which they feel sheltered, and in a way in which allows them to see a future for themselves and their family.
I mean, that's a wonderful outlook. Obviously, civility. That's not the reality, though, in Washington, sadly. And again, aside from meditation, how do you work across the aisle?
You work across the aisle by telling the truth. And I think that's something that the American people want us to spend more time holding folks accountable to. The truth is people are living in deep poverty. The truth is we have a country that's incredibly polarized because we're leaning on rhetoric and propaganda and not the realities of people living in communities and districts and cities and states across this country. The reality is people have put politics over working to find solutions that make sense for the American people. I'm incredibly grateful and humbled that I'm representing a district that is incredibly blue. But folks in blue states want the same thing as folks in red states. They want food they can afford, gas prices they can afford. They want shelter. They want public education that makes sense. They want health care that they can afford.
What do you want to attempt? Okay, toward that end, those ends, what do you want to do? What's the first thing on your agenda that you want to bring up, that you want to explore?
Well, truthfully, the first thing on my agenda is, you know, getting my office and hiring my staff. We're in the throes of new member orientation right now, and it's incredibly overwhelming. I want to look at a number of the pieces of legislation that Congresswoman Karen Bass worked on. You know, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act is incredibly important to me. I got the Crisis Act signed into law in the state of California. That is in her bill. I want to work to make sure that's passed into law. I want to focus on economic justice issues, why we are dealing with the housing and affordability crisis that is crippling folks across this country, how we can push lenders, nonprofit agencies, and government to work in a more streamlined way to grant greater access to capital so that folks can get out of poverty. I want to work on national child care legislation that will be permanent. I want to fight to protect our Social Security and our Medicare. We know that those things are on the chopping block, along with a potential national ban on abortion. There is a very long list of real priorities that are important to me and my constituents.
Your path to politics is a bit unconventional. You were going to USC in 1992 when the uprising happened after the Rodney King verdict. What was it that set you on the path to public service? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'm really a girl from Chicago. I came out here to go to USC. I was here in the midst of the riots, and I saw what it was like when a city stop talking to itself. It's very similar to the space that we're in right now, if you think about it. And I fell in love with this city, the opportunity, the diversity, the aspirational sensibilities that so many folks here have. I took a little break from Los Angeles after the earthquake because that scared a Midwestern girl like me, but I came back and worked in the nonprofit world. I worked in the entertainment industry and then eventually made my way to a nonprofit organization called Crystal Stairs that helps families find and pay for childcare. So my story is very winding, but it's also allowed me an opportunity to meet so many different kinds of folks and to hear their stories. I've channeled all of those stories and testimonies and frustrations in each of my runs for office.
You mentioned the things that you want to do as a member of Congress. You mentioned George Floyd. And, you know, when it comes to criminal justice reform, do you think the movement has lost steam across the country as more time has passed since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which was obviously such a pivotal moment?
No, I don't think the movement has lost steam, but I do think time has allowed for nuances to bubble up to the surface. And so things aren't binary, right? It's not public safety or not. It's really sort of looking at how complex and how complicated the issue around criminal justice reform and public safety are, and how do you unwind some of the systemic injustices that have become codified into law and have become practiced over time and institutionalized. So I think we're in a moment where we can talk about, you know, how we continue to reform probation, how we look at treatments, how the treatment inside of jails and inside of prisons. You know, at the federal level, there's been an uptick in sexual violence and assault in our federal prisons. And how are we addressing that? How are we looking at gate money, what you get when you leave prison, either federal or state prison, to help you as you re-enter society and try to rehabilitate? You know, those are also elements and components of criminal justice reform work that we haven't been talking about. And so I think this is a great opportunity for us to continue to unpack all that criminal justice reform really means.
Democrats owe their successes in the midterms in part to the backlash against the overturning of Roe v. Wade over the summer. What can Democrats deliver on that, given the conservative court and a very divided Congress, as we mentioned? Any kind of amendment similar to what voters just passed in California is obviously unlikely. So how do you move forward on that issue?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting is that states across the country that had some sort of abortion protection bill on the ballot, Democrats fared quite well in those states. And states that didn't, Democrats had a harder time. You know, I think it's important that we stand up and say no to the legislation that Senator Lindsey Graham is proposing around an abortion ban. And we have to continue to talk about what this means for pregnant people and women. So I think as long as Democrats keep talking about real life issues and the consequences of the Dobbs reversal, we will be on track to continue to make some changes that will reverse that dreadful and in some instances fatal decision.
People have made the comparison between L.A. and D.C., you know, entertainment and politics. And actually, I didn't realize until now that your mother was actually an actress. Is that that's right?
She still is. She still
she is. She still is. Yeah. What do you make of that comparison? Entertainment and politics, you know, L.A. and D.C., very different places.
Well, different sides of the same coin. You know, all of this, I say, is theater. You're either buying a ticket and sitting in the theater seats, or you're turning on your television and watching something on C-SPAN. You know, at the end of the day, it really is about storytelling. How are you capturing constituents' stories, their aspirations, successes, and pain, and channeling that into policy that makes a difference for everyone? And sometimes that includes some theatrics, because how are you going to make your case? And sometimes you have to dial down the drama because folks want to see you really working. So I certainly think I have taken some cues from my mother, but I have to say she's so excited. She came out to Los Angeles election night for my election night watch party. And for the first time in a very long time, she was not the star of the night, but she was beaming from ear to ear. And I keep getting texts from her every day saying how proud she is. So it's really been a humbling experience.
Do you think Democrats really push it when it comes to politics, though, as much as Republicans do? When we talk about entertainment and theatrics and things like that, there, I mean, up until this year, obviously Democrats did pretty well considering in the midterms, but it's been hard for Democrats to win in elections where there have been lies spouted by the other side, election deniers, people like that. How do Democrats fight harder in that kind of an environment?
I think Democrats fought harder. I think we were a little more strategic and quiet. You know, we did not broadcast our strategy, but we worked it on the ground with volunteers, with candidates of high quality, and we talked about the issues. We know how to win, and we know how to connect with people. And as long as we continue to keep doing that, we will continue to win. And I think these midterms showed that folks respect what we're trying to do, and they have respect for what has happened this past year in Congress with this administration.
Sydney Kamlager, Congressmember-elect for House District 37. That's Karen Bass's old seat, which includes parts of South and West L.A., Inglewood, and Culver City. I want to thank you, Madam Congresswoman-elect, for coming on, and congratulations again to you, and good luck.
Thank you for this. I had a great time.
By the way, we have some other election news today. L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva conceded the election after he was defeated by retired Long Beach Police Chief Robert Luna. Robert Luna will become the next Los Angeles County Sheriff. That's going to do it for us today. Check us out on web at kcrw.com/GLA. While you're there, tell us how you're doing. And, of course, we'd be honored if you subscribe to the podcast, too, at kcrw.com/GLA. Or get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your ears. Have a great night.